From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. In just a few decades, we'll find ourselves living on a more cramped planet. There are over 7 billion people on Earth right now, but by 2050, that number is expected to be 10 billion. There will be large implications for water, food, and electricity, but shortages are already taking place. In Cape Town, South Africa, water is expected to run out by April. Where do we go from here? This hour on Point, life in a world with 10 billion people. You can join us on air or online. Can you get your head around a world with 10 billion people in it? What are the biggest challenges? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, we'll talk about how researchers in China have cloned monkeys using the technique that produced Dolly the sheep more than 20 years ago. But first, joining me now from Portland, Oregon, is Charles C. Mann. He's a correspondent for The Atlantic, Science, and Wired magazines. His new book is The Wizard and the Prophet, Two Remarkable Scientists and Their Dueling Visions to Shape Tomorrow's World, which was released this week. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Charles Mann, great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Jane.
So the idea of 10 billion people inhabiting the Earth struck you after your daughter was born. Tell us what happened.
When my daughter was born 19 years ago, after mother and child who had done all the work needed to rest, the hospital threw me out at 3 o'clock in the morning. And as I was stepping off the curb into the parking lot, it suddenly occurred to me that when she was my age, there'd be almost 10 billion people in the world. And at some level, I'd known that already, but now maybe I had more skin in the game. And I thought, boy, how's that going to work? And over the next 19 years, from time to time when I've had the possibility, I've talked to scientists, researchers, conservationists, people of all sorts. And after a while, I realized when I said, what are we going to do, that their answers fell into two broad categories, each of which, at least in my mind, was associated with a researcher hardly anybody had ever heard of, but who they had heard of and kept mentioning their names.
And who were they?
Well, one is Norman Borlaug, and he's the main figure in what's been called the Green Revolution, which is the combination of high-yield seeds for grain, high-intensity fertilizer, and irrigation that enormously boosted grain yields all over the world in the 70s and 80s and caused the then current predictions of famine not to happen.
Right. And saved millions from starvation, right?
Right. Yeah. And he is the sort of emblem of the idea that science and technology, properly applied, can let us produce our way out of these problems.
And the other one is a man named William
Vogt.
Vogt.
And he is the, more than anyone else, the founding figure in the environmental movement. And he wrote the first modern We're All Going to Hell book, Road to Survival, in 1948. And he put together the fundamental idea of behind the environmental movement, which is the idea of limits. And he called it carrying capacity. There's other terms, ecological limits, planetary boundaries. But it's essentially the insight that the Earth is finite and our ability to work in it is constrained by the need to work within ecological systems. And if we overstep those limits, very bad things can happen. And so his argument was we need to conserve. And his book led to the ideas, we have to put on our cardigan sweaters and turn down the thermostat and eat lower in the food chain, all those things that you're very familiar with. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, these two ideas are the opposite from each other.
So why did you put them together in a book?
Well, it seemed like this is the kind of alternative paths that were offered as a way to think about the future. I didn't want to write a book about the future that made a lot of predictions because those predictions always turn out to be wrong. Rather, this is a book about how to think about the future. I imagine my daughter, who's now in college, maybe being able to read this book and sort of getting all the facts laid out, here's the ideas, and then she can make up her mind herself.
So the idea that the planet becoming overcrowded to the extent that we understand it to be, 10 billion people without enough food is alarming. I mean, you can talk about, what we do about it, what these two men might suggest or a path, forward. But what's the line from an author's perspective? You write this book and you put this out there. What's the line between making people aware and not causing an overreaction or even panic?
Well, that's something I thought about a lot, of course. And one thing I hoped was that I think there's plenty of ways that we can avoid this. And in some sense, both of these paths seem, at least to me at the moment, possible. The question is, which one shall we choose? Because they have very, very different implications about how we live. And more than anything else, these two paths reflect differing perceptions about what is good, what is a good life, and how do we coexist with nature.
So give us an example of the implications of what we're looking at moving forward from the different perspectives that you've written about.
Well, taking for an example, water. As we all know from the issues in Cape Town, the world is getting running short of water. And there's amazingly little fresh water. And so wizards say, well, the answer is to make more and have giant desalination plants. And if you look at maps of California, you'll realize there's 20-plus gigantic desalination plants that have been proposed. And this is the same true for places like the Mediterranean. The prophets look at this, and the prophets – I should immediately say that the wizards are what I call people who think like Borlaug.
Yeah.
The there's technical fixes.
So Norman Borlaug is the wizard. William Voigt is the prophet. Right.
Right. I, you know, in theory, I should really call him something like a technophiliac meliorist or something.
Well, but, stop right there. Why those titles? Where'd you get those, and why'd you label them that way?
Well, it's interesting because this is the idea. They very much like kind of disruptive innovation. Mm-hmm. And maybe the word Schumpeter is involved in there as the economist who's sort of brought that to attention. And they love technology. And they're meliorists, or they see that you can constantly improve human life. And so actually those are the right terms, but you know, it's you can't inflict that on readers. And so I just said, look, think of them as wizards, you know, techno-wizards. And the other is the prophets. And maybe they should be called you know, something like neo-Burkean processualists or something. Because Burke was the philosopher who said, you know, things are as they are for a reason, don't disturb them, and focuses on these sort of systems and processes and tries to fit themselves in it. But that, again, is something you don't want to inflict on readers, so I call them a prophet.
I see. All right. So take us back. Let's talk about food, actually, the demands for food and how we'll exceed the Earth's capacity to feed everyone by 2050. I mean, talk about that in the context of these two perspectives.
Okay. Well, first, there's going to be, 25% more people. And not only are there going to be more people, but if things continue and affluence continues to increase, there's going to be 25% more people. A huge percentage of them are going to be affluent, and they're going to want all the things that we want. You know, they're going to want heating. They're going to have air conditioning. They're going to want nice cars. They're going to want good food. They're probably going to want meat. They're going to want occasional treats. In fact, they're going to want Toblerone. In fact, at one point, I was going to call the book Toblerone for $10 billion. But my editor vetoed that for obvious reasons. And so we need to increase the food by some amount. And there's a lot of argument about how much it is, but quite a bit. So let's just say quite a bit. Where's it going to come from? And if you're a wizard, if you're one of these people who want to see techno fixes everywhere, you say genetically modified food. And, you know, I give a big example in the book. There's these big mega projects for changing the way photosynthesis works in rice, and that's called the C4 Rice Initiative. It's the biggest plant science project around, but there's also other ones to make self-fertilizing corn, you know, corn that's like soy that fertilizes itself, wheat that can grow in salt water, lots of different kinds of things that fundamentally change how productive these plants could be. And the idea is that you continue along as we have with industrial agriculture, except that you make it smarter and even better and, you know, keep going along the road pioneered by Borlaug.
And so what would the prophets say?
Well, the prophets think this is nuts because industrial agriculture has caused, you know, tremendous damage to Earth systems. There, about 40% of the massive amount of fertilizer that goes onto these, you know, high-tech farms gets washed off. It goes into the oceans and it creates these huge dead zones. It goes up into the air in the form of nitrous oxides. It interferes with the ozone layer. And they say, look, you want to do more of this? You know, it also, the irrigation has led to tremendous salinization. As the water evaporates, it leaves salts behind and poisons the soil. You can go on and on. And so for them, they say, look, what we need are farms that much more mimic natural systems and possibly a completely different kind of suite of crops. And so if you grew, you know, polycultures with trees and tubers, these are fantastically productive and are, you know, arguably easier on the soil and on the ecological processes that we're talking about trying to respect.
So do you pick an answer, Charles Mann? I mean, you give both perspectives, and I'm curious, do you land on one? I feel like as I'm listening to you, gosh, we've got enough polarized perspectives in this country right now. Do we need another?
Well, I'm not trying to poise. I'm just sort of saying, look, these are the kind of paths that people envision. And if you're the sort of person who values maximal individual liberty, and then you typically want people to live in cities where you have the most freedom, and you know without so many people in the countryside. But if you're a person who values community, then you typically imagine these sort of smaller scale networked communities. And these obviously have different resonances depending on who you are. And I think that's what I'm trying to say is that so many of these things we argue about, is this practical, is this useful, and they're really about what is good.
Mm. How does population shift to the middle class and affluence play into this conversation as we look ahead to 2050 and 10 billion people on this planet?
Well, for food, so far as populations have gotten more affluent, they want to eat more meat. And it takes more land, essentially, more grain to produce more meat. So if populations do what they have in the past and the demand for meat grows up, it means we have to grow a whole lot more grain. And the question is, there's nothing inherent about being affluent that says meat. So the question is, if these populations become more affluent, do they have to do what they've done in the past?
Mm. And what about
if they do, it can make things harder.
In what way?
Well, when you said, for instance, at the top of the hour that we need to double food production, the assumption there is everybody goes on a Western diet, the kind of Western middle class diet that you see all over the United States. If everybody in the world does that, we will have to, in fact, do something like double food production. But, you know, if a significant number of people say, oh, I don't want hamburgers every day, I want, like, apparently what you get every day in Portland, Oregon, which is avocado toast, then... Right? And those are just as expensive as hamburgers. You know, if you want to be luxurious that way, obviously that has different implications about what's happening on the farm.
Hmm. What'd you learn from this book? What'd you learn from this research? What struck you the most?
I guess what struck me the most is how incredibly changeable people can be. And I guess I'm going to trail off meaningfully with that.
Hey, it's Ophira Eisenberg, host of Ask Me Another. We headed out to L.A. for two all-celebrity contestant shows, and the competition was more intense than the traffic on the 405. Linda Cardellini, Jeff Garlin, Lance Reddick, and Paul Rust. Only one took home an Ask Me Another Rubik's Cube. Find Ask Me Another on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking about a crowded planet and whether Earth and its resources can sustain 10 billion people. You can join the conversation. If a major city like Cape Town can run out of water, is anything possible? Can we innovate our way out of this? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Great guest today, Charles C. Mann. His new book is The Wizard and the Prophet, Two Remarkable Scientists and Their Dueling Visions to Shape Tomorrow's World. Here's a 1970 Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech where agronomist and humanitarian Norman Borlaug talked about the vital role of food production and agriculture in addressing world hunger.
There can be no permanent progress in the battle against hunger until the agencies that fight for increased food production and those that fight for population control unite in a common effort. Fighting alone, they may win temporary skirmishes, but united they can win a decisive and lasting victory to provide food and the other amenities of a progressive civilization.
So that's interesting. Fighting alone, they may win temporary skirmishes, but united they can win a decisive and lasting victory. What do you hear in that speech? Norman Borlaug there at the Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech. You wrote so much about him. What do you hear in that? Charles?
Well, Borlaug is the wizard of my title, and he is the emblem of the idea that science and technology properly applied can let you produce your way out of these problems. And you hear it right there, right? You know, we need to make more. We need to make more.
Right.
The other thing that I hear at least there is something that he and Vogt, the prophet of my title, shared, which is kind of a blindness to social science. They both came from a biological perspective. You know, different parts of it, Borlaug essentially came from genetics, Vogt from ecology. But they thought of us as biological units, as biological creatures. And in fact, we're much more complicated than that, for better or worse. And so the population control measures that he advocated back there in 1970, were actually many of them were applied in the 70s and 80s, and the results were horrific. They're nothing that he had envisioned or ever wanted to have happen. But in fact, there are these huge programs of forced sterilization in India and China and the Philippines, elsewhere in Southeast Asia, parts of Africa. Huge numbers of women were forced into abortions. There's tremendous family suffering everywhere. And it really didn't even have that much impact because, again, he was just sort of thinking that we're animals like every other animal and didn't imagine how these kinds of programs would feed into the systems of authority and control. and the social systems of these different countries, and they fit in very badly with terrible results.
Mm. That's interesting. Let me get a listener in Madison, Wisconsin, and here Chris is on the line. Hi, Chris. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, great show as usual.
Thank you.
You know, I have been thinking about this for a while also, and it is why I believe that the next great war will be fought over water, and why I have for several years been stockpiling non-perishable food and water and training my children to save money and buy land that is defendable near a water source.
So, Chris, thank you very much. Charles Mann, I mean, I'm just curious because everyone has their own ideas, but because you've been studying this so closely, what do you do about water? We talk about water conservation and water shortages. I mean, how do you view this on a personal level?
Well, I can reassure Chris a little bit. One of the very striking things when you study history is actually how few water wars there have been. We know that there was one back in Mesopotamia. This has been studied, you know, amply by historians, and there hasn't been a war about water for 4,500 years. So it's possible, of course, that they may happen in the future. But the striking thing is how often, when there's been tremendous shortages of water and conflict over them, that at the last minute, people have come together. And there's an enormously strong record of that. So it's possible this may change, but there's some comfort in history there. Now, what I think personally is I'm struck by, again, how often these battles are very old. And here, in the case, the wizards, if you call it the people who advance technical solutions, what they want to have is giant desalination plants, sometimes powered by nuclear power, and the prophets argue for conservation. And both of them could, in theory, work.
Hmm. Well, since we're talking about water, let's go to Cape Town, South Africa. They're expected to run out of water in April. Let me get from Johannesburg, South Africa, Deborah Patta, CBS News foreign correspondent. She's been reporting on the drought in Cape Town. Deborah, welcome to On Point. How great to have you.
Hi, DJ.
So tell me what's happening in Cape Town. You're running out of water. Give us the sense of the problem.
It's kind of bizarre, really, because Cape Town is, you know, one of the most beautiful spots in the world, a massive tourist destination, and it is surrounded by water. Literally everywhere you look, there are stretches of beautiful ocean. It is surrounded by both the Indian and the Atlantic Ocean. So when people look at it, they think, this isn't a drought. This is a beautiful seaside city. But it is running out of water because of three successive droughts in that province. And basically, the city can no longer cope with its population and the tourists coming in. There have been massive water restrictions in place, but now they've set a day. It's ominously called Day Zero. It was initially the 21st of April, but due to further restrictions, it's been brought forward. And the 12th of April is now the day when the government says the taps will be switched off unless they can somehow stretch the existing water supplies. Mm. Dams are very low at the moment, so it is a very worrying situation.
Mm. I'm going to play some sound here, Deborah, from a piece you did on the CBS Evening News. It's two Cape Town residents telling you what it's like in Johannesburg under these current water restrictions.
Imagine no water. How will it be? Chaos. It's going to be terrible.
It has changed our lives dramatically, you know. But, I mean, it's also a lesson for us not to waste water.
And here's a news conference from last Thursday. Cape Town Mayor Patricia de Lille describing how dire the water situation is in South Africa.
The chances of reaching day zero on the 21st of April is now very likely. We can no longer ask people to stop wasting water. We now have to force them to stop wasting water.
So what's the cause of this, Deborah Patta?
Well, three successive droughts. Nobody could have predicted that. We knew that there, you know, was a drought and went on for a second year and now a third year. So there basically was not enough rain in the province of the Western Cape, and that has caused a shortage of water. But added to that, you have the issue of climate change. We spoke to a climate scientist who said that even if they get good rainfalls in Cape Town this year, it won't be enough because Cape Town is getting hotter. Every year, temperatures are much higher than the previous year, and what you're seeing is the problem of evaporation. So the water evaporates as the temperature increases. So going forward, there won't be enough water. So although there might not be the severe water restrictions in the future, there certainly are going to always be some kind of restrictions in place, he suggests, in Cape Town.
Hmm. Deborah, hold on. Charles Mann, jump back in here. Goodness, taps going dry in Cape Town in April. I mean, talk about this in the context of your study, your research, and history.
Well, one of the things is that many towns, including Cape Town, have tremendous problems with leakage. Something in, on average around the world, something like a third of the water used in urban systems is just simply leaked out because cities and countries don't maintain them. This includes reservoirs that are improperly sealed, pipes that leak, and then on top of that, you have huge water wastage. And again, this is from the point of view of conservation-minded profits. In places like Cape Town, there are lawns, there are big golf courses. There are any number of sources where the water is essentially pumped out into the open and simply evaporated into the air. And so if you're somebody like William Vogt, you say, this is completely nuts. What we need to do is not create a new system for water. We need to use the water that we already have much more intelligently.
So Deborah Patter, day to day, what is it like in Cape Town? I mean, how do people live? How do they cook? How do they consume water?
That's a very good question. At the present moment, Cape Townians are only allowed 23 gallons of water per person. That goes down to 13 gallons next month. You compare that to the average American who uses, according to most studies, around 100 gallons daily. I mean, that's an average estimate. So that's not very much water.
Right.
13 gallons, which is what it's going to go down to in a week's time, will allow for a 90-second shower, a quick toilet flush, maybe some dishwashing, a large bottle of drinking water, some water for your pets, and some very, very basic water for cooking. So what Catonians are doing, and unfortunately this is the biggest problem, because only about a third of the population are complying with the water restrictions. They, for example, will shower in a bucket, and then you collect the water in the bucket. You use what is called the grey water to either flush your toilet. It used to be watering the garden, but most people who are complying with water restrictions have just let their gardens go. So you use that to flush the water, and everywhere you can, you try and conserve water. Whenever there's a little bit of rain, you'll see Cape Townians running outside with their buckets to try and collect the water and use it. So as many times as you can reuse water is what people are doing. There's a natural spring in one of the suburbs in Cape Town, and every day you'll see queues of people with 25-litre water vats collecting water that they take home. You're only allowed 25 litres, and so people queue there. Sometimes they queue for their neighbours and for the elderly who are unable to get there, just to add to their stash of water. You can buy these big water vats from the supermarkets as well, but last time we checked, they'd actually been sold out. They'd obviously get more in. But it's a very difficult situation. I think for a lot of people, it's a shock. They can't quite believe that this is really going to happen, and there is a lot of denial.
Sounds like it. With only a third of the people complying, it looks like when the taps go dry in April, there will be forced compliance. Deborah Patter, thank you so much there from Johannesburg, South Africa, CBS News foreign correspondent. Deborah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Charles Mann, what did you hear in there?
I was struck by how common this is in a certain way. They're at the leading edge of a phenomenon that's all over the world, which is that there's going to be water shortages, and you need to have some plan to deal with them. They are surrounded by the ocean. They could have put in desalination plants, as California has done, as Israel has done, or they could have fixed up their infrastructure. They could have banned lawns. There's any number of things that can happen. And the main problem is that solutions exist, but they aren't implemented.
Let's get Nick in here from Weston, Massachusetts. Hi, Nick. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane.
Hi,
Mr. Mann. I think it's absolutely right. We've got to work on resources, food and water. But it would really be upsetting to me if you don't look at the basic fundamental problem of how to slow or prevent rapid population growth. Now, I think you'd be ashamed to finish the hour without looking at that whole other issue. And I lived in Southern Africa for years. I know the droughts there. They've been around for centuries. The problem is how to provide women and couples with the choice of whether to have a child. That's missing from your discussion today.
And we're getting there, Nick. Let's pick it up right now. I mean, there have been historically concerns about population growth. And quite frankly, Charles, that's led to horrific conditions for millions of women and men around the world. Talk about that in the context of our caller's concerns.
Well, there were, as just as you say, there are big anti-population campaigns in the 1970s, 1980s, and all the way up into the 1990s, primarily in Asia, primarily in big countries like China and India, but also in places like Africa and Latin America. And they led to horrific human rights abuses. Typically, sort of poorly trained people would be sent out there and they'd be given incentives for the number of women that they would sterilize, for the number of IUDs that they would insert. And you can imagine the kinds of abuses that came from that. In places like India, women had to get sterilized in order or have IUDs inserted. And that's a more benign version if they wanted to, you know, send their children to school, if they wanted to be able to obtain certain kinds of government assistance and so forth. So there's a real coercion element to it. And as most scientists, social scientists now regard, they weren't actually all that effective. What is really effective is empowering women by giving them education, the opportunities to earn a living, and so forth. And that has had an absolutely huge impact and has been the driver for the fact that actually population growth is slowing and that most researchers believe that somewhere around after we hit about 10 billion, it's going to slow and it's going to stick around 10, 11, maybe possibly 12 billion for as far as we can see and then slowly decline.
Charles Mann, you mentioned this, so I'm going to play this clip. In 2014, several women died after undergoing state-sponsored sterilization surgery in India. Here's CNN correspondent Sumnina Undas describing what the Indian government calls its family planning initiative.
It's a way for the Indian government to rein the population here, which is expected to top China's by 2028, becoming the world's most populous nation. So what happens is in these states, in these local districts, health officials go from village to village, setting up these mobile camps, performing these sterilization surgeries for free, and even giving a reward to a lot of these women, the equivalent of about $20.
And here, China's one-child policy ended in 2015. Many Chinese were overjoyed. Here's CNN reporter Matt Rivers in Beijing on the day the policy ended.
The one-child policy was extremely unpopular among many everyday Chinese. The system led to a bureaucracy employing hundreds of thousands to enforce the law. Couples were forced to pay heavy fines for having a second child, but many could not afford it. So forced abortions and sterilizations became a regular occurrence, according to many human rights groups.
Forced abortions, forced sterilizations, the one China policy, one child policy in China and India. Charles Mann, speak to this. I mean, do you worry these injustices can happen again? We are talking about an overcrowded planet, but there are a lot of problems on both sides.
One of the classic books on this is Reproductive Rights and Wrongs by Betsy Hartman that I think came out in 1988. That was one of the first to expose what was going on. And I interviewed her a few times for my book, and she is extremely worried that this will happen all over again if we don't realize that the path towards empowering women is more effective and actually obviously better in almost every way. And you can see this by the fact that population growth, the rate of population growth has declined in China and in India that had these forced measures. But then you go to Southeast Asia, which didn't have them, and population has declined there even faster.
Let's get Dan in here quickly from Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Dan. I'm up against the clock. Be quick, if you wouldn't mind.
Okay. Thanks, Jane.
Yeah.
This is a subject I've been talking about for a long time, and no one that I'm around seems to really see it as an issue or really thinks about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I see a lot of the points that are made. But at the root of everything, I see human beings as being behind everything. And I think we're finally getting to the root. When you look at pollution, too many plastic bottles, when you look at global warming, the one common factor in all of these things are people. Mm. And I know that I just listened to the way China handled it and India handled it.
Yeah.
But if you look at the way that we've handled cigarette smoking, there's no law against it. There's laws you can't smoke in certain places. It fell out of favor.
Yeah, Nick, I'm sorry I got to cut in there, but I do appreciate your call. Thank you. We're discussing water, food, survival on a planet, a very crowded planet with 10 billion people, and you can join the conversation. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Ever get to Friday, look back on the week, and say to yourself, what just happened? I'm Sam Sanders. Check out my podcast, It's Been a Minute, where every Friday we catch up on the news and the culture of the week and try to make sense of it all. Listen on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking about an increasingly crowded world this hour, and if the Earth can handle it, you can join the conversation. Do solutions need to start on the world stage in Washington, on the grassroots level, in your own home? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guest today, Charles C. Mann. His new book is The Wizard and the Prophet, Two Remarkable Scientists and Their Dueling Visions to Shape Tomorrow's World. I've got a lot of calls, Charles. Let's get Nate in here from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi, Nate. Welcome to the program. Nate, are you there? Guess not. Here's Andy in Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Andy. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane. I'm a frequent caller. This is a topic that is of extreme passion to me. I take the side of the prophet. I believe that it's ridiculous to think that we can fix the problems that we have with technology when technology is the thing that caused our population to explode in the first place and our environment to degrade. So I think that the solution to these issues long-term, and it's probably not a perfect solution, but I think it's going to be generational. I think what we need to do is we need to commit to educating the next generation on self-reliance and self-sufficiency. I don't believe that governments and corporations and large institutions are going to solve these problems for us. And I think it's evident if you look back at when these population control measures were taking place. It was very aggressive and cruel. Mm-hmm. I think that if we can educate our next generation very carefully, make it core curriculum on self-sufficiency, controlling our own population, we may have a chance here. And just one other thing, the first caller, the guy who said he was stockpiling food and water, I do the same thing. I have land up north, and we're retiring there, and we're getting ready for it ourselves, my wife and I, because what I see here is the only way to fix this problem is to lower my personal impact and to be self-reliant so I can get ready for the future.
Whatever it may be. Andy, thank you very much for that great call. Charles Mann, what about it? Do solutions need to start on the grassroots level? Do you see solutions needed in Washington, on the world stage? How do you view it?
Kind of it depends on whether you're a wizard and you believe in technical solutions or you're a prophet and you believe in conserving and fitting in with the environment. If you're a wizard and you believe in technical solutions, typically those are very large. For climate change, wizards advocate nuclear power plants because they are carbon free, and you're not going to build one of those yourself in your backyard. Prophets like very much like something like backyard solar. So your preference for these things kind of stems more from who you are than from some kind of immutable law of nature. Mm. And it seemed very appropriate to me that your caller sees himself as being much more of a local person, having a small footprint he can, and he's going to move up north and probably have as much as he can, power himself by solar power. Mm-hmm. The wizards say, wait a minute, that's going to take up a huge amount of land, having all those solar installations for neighborhoods. Why don't we pack them all into utilities? And the same thing for farms. If I live in western Massachusetts, not very far from your caller. If I wanted to grow wheat, it's not really very fertile soil for wheat for my bread. And I would actually, to produce a loaf of bread, I would use far more land than somebody in much more fertile soil in Illinois. And so the wizards would argue and say, actually, you could do more damage that way. Hmm. I think either are possible, but you have to be very careful about how you do it and sort of think it through.
What about energy issues, Charles Mann? How would a wizard and a prophet think about, centralized power plants with coal and oil versus solar power and wind? I mean, talk about the importance of that as we're looking ahead.
Well, energy is obviously, just as you say, Jane, a super important issue. the thing that really surprised me, or one of the things that really surprised me when I began researching the book, is that the fight between advocates of fossil fuels and advocates of solar power has been going on for more than a century. The oil industry really began in the 1860s in Pennsylvania, but so did the solar industry, with people taking these solar collectors that look kind of like lampshades upside down, lined with mirrors, and using them to boil water and drive steam engines. In 1872, there's a demonstration in the middle of Paris in the Jardin des Tuileries of a solar-powered printing press. And always in the past, the fossil fuel guys have won because they've been able to generate so much power from a single centralized source. And it's only quite recently, as we begin to understand the byproducts of fossil fuels, which is climate change, that the battle has resumed on a more equal level. And now you have two visions of society, one, both of which, you know, ultimately stem back from the 1870s, one of big centralized facilities that feed out power, whether they be huge collecting solar power arrays or nuclear power or what have you, and the other of a networked, much more small-scale, localized system of windmills and tiny solar plantations. Hmm. And it's going to be very interesting to see what society eventually chooses.
Let's get Dave in here from Stowe, Massachusetts. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane. Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call and for this really important conversation. First, really quickly, I generally fall in the profit camp, but I'm also not anti-technology. I work in renewable energy. I have solar panels on my roof. And I just received an artificial hip, which has made my life wonderful. That all having been said, I think it would be really interesting to talk about, there's two points I'd like to make. I think it's really interesting to talk about the next stage beyond what the profits and technologists are thinking about. Mm-hmm. Growth in consumption and population is the problem. That's already been said. But we need to come up with an economic system that works on a steady state. And that's blasphemous. And my other point is, having worked in conservation for 35 years, and I always think about this, I'm a survivalist in the way that the other people have talked, few other people have mentioned as well.
But in
conservation, nobody knows this in my field for the most part, but I got a speaker to an annual festival that we do in Vermont. I'm on the board of directors of Solarfest, and we had this speaker. I've known that that conservation has been saving us for years, and over the past 70 years since 1950,
yep.
If one does an honest analysis, literally 75% to 80% of the increase in energy usage has come from energy conservation.
Interesting.
It wasn't always planned.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to cut you off, Dave, because our time is so short. I only have a couple of minutes. I do appreciate your call. Charles Mann, what did you hear in caller Dave there?
Energy conservation is the one thing that both sides of this debate, wizards and prophets, agree on, I think. The more energy you conserve, the less you have to generate. And so I couldn't agree more with him, and I think neither side would want to disagree. Question is, we have about 1 billion people on the Earth without electricity, 400 million in India alone. How are we going to provide it to them? Right now, the momentum is basically to provide it with big coal plants because they're easy, they're cheap, and so forth. And it's going to take significant investment to provide them from some other way. And that's really where the battlefield is going to be. Are we, instead of using the coal plants, going to have some other giant centralized facilities, or are we going to scatter them around? And that, in turn, depends on the kind of institutions and incentives that are set up in places like India, Kenya, West China, and so on. Mm.
Got 1 minute left. What's the takeaway, Charles Mann? What's the takeaway from all this?
I think that when we look at these things, we should not feel unoptimistic. And the reason is, if you think about it, all of these involve big transformations to society. But go back to 1800 and think, in every place in the world in 1800, slavery was common. Women couldn't own property. Homosexuals were, you know, forbidden from the public square. Come to 2018, enormous changes have taken place. And so we have demonstrated clearly the ability to change what we do for the better. And we should be able to do the same thing as we confront the challenges of tomorrow.
So after all this, after all your research and writing this book, do you feel in any way that you're tilting one side or another? Do you feel like you're tilting to be a wizard? Do you feel like you're tilting to be a prophet? Would you let us in on the secret?
No, it's not so much that. But it's really, when you do that, it's really, I'm just a matter of personal preference.
Yeah.
And my vote is just the same as anybody else's.
Well, the planet our kids will inherit will be dramatically different than the one into which we were born. Big questions.
And it could be
better. Good big questions to tackle, and you've helped us think about that. Charles Mann, thank you very much. Author of The Wizard and the Prophet. Really appreciate your time today, Charles. Thank you.
It's my pleasure.
In a moment, listeners, we'll get to the first primate. It's been cloned. This is On Point. Twenty years ago, scientists cloned a sheep named Dolly using a technique called nuclear transfer. Now they've done it with monkeys. Researchers in China reported yesterday that they've created two long-tailed macaques from fetal cells grown in a petri dish. That success means we are closer to cloning humans than ever before. What are the ethical questions here? For perspective, we turn to Dina Fine-Marin, editor of Health and Science at the Scientific American. You can link to her piece headlined First Primate Clones Produced Using the Dolly Method. That's at our website, onpointradio.org. Dina, welcome to the program. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jane.
So tell us exactly what's happened in China. What did scientists do?
Yeah, so for the first time, scientists in China were able to use this cloning technique that was used on Dolly more than 20 years ago. It's called somatic cell nuclear transfer, and it essentially involves swapping the nucleus of a donor cell into a fertilized egg that has been purged of all its own DNA, and that egg will then contain an exact copy of the donor's genome. Then if that's implanted into a surrogate mother, the eventual offspring will be a clone, and that's what happened with these two macaque monkeys.
So do scientists believe this will be easy to replicate? Was this sort of a fluke that it happened, that it worked out?
So that's a great question. Actually, their success was really minimal this time around, so there's still a lot of room for improvement, which means that though they tried to do this more than 100 times, there were only these two successes. So with that extremely low success rate, that means human cloning, for one thing, is definitely not around the corner.
Okay, because why? Tell us more about that.
Sure. So first off, they were only successful with this technique when they used fetal cells, that's cells from aborted fetuses. So we aren't at a time where we could take a person's cells, which would officially be called adult cells, and successfully reprogram them to make a clone. The Chinese scientists tried to use adult cells with no success. Also, as I mentioned, the success rate with these macaque monkeys, we're still extremely, extremely low. So ethicists and scientists alike wouldn't want to make that hazardous try with humans at this point.
So tell us how this compares, what scientists have done in China. How does that compare to what scientists did with Dolly the sheep 20 years ago? What's the difference?
So since Dolly, scientists have managed to do the same thing with more than 20 different species, including pigs, for example, on top of sheep. But when researchers tried using the same approach on monkeys, they managed to produce fetuses, but no pregnancy actually was able to lead to a healthy newborn. Every pregnancy ended after about 80 days. The main obstacle, the Chinese researchers wrote, was likely that the transferred nuclei didn't contain proper instructions to support embryonic development. So this time around, the Chinese team deployed two critical enzymes that managed to scrub the epigenetic memory of being somatic cells, meaning the cells that make up tissues and organs. And that allowed, they think, this pregnancy to proceed to term and lead to these two healthy clones.
Mm. So the United States is actually moving away from the use of primates in medical research. I'm just curious how U.S. researchers are reacting to what scientists in China have done. Would this ever happen in the United States? Could we do it?
That's a great question. As far as whether or not we could do it, again, only this one team has managed to do this so far, so whether or not other research teams will be able to follow these same instructions remains unclear. But researchers I spoke with were really excited about this breakthrough. In particular, they were wondering if they could create large colonies of monkeys that they could test human diseases on. So, for example, if you have a population of primates that are all genetically identical, that could be a really great model to study human disease. Things like, how do environmental factors affect cancer, or how do people who have a specific genetic mutation react to a certain drug. Obviously, that seems really appealing to do, but as you mentioned, there has been a big move in the U.S. and Europe and elsewhere to move away from primate research due to ethical concerns about experimenting on our close genetic relatives. And in the United States, U.S. government biomedical research on chimpanzees is effectively over. All lab chimps are being slowly retired. So when you talk about this area of research against the backdrop of this hesitancy to work with primates, that will have to be an ongoing discussion.
I'm looking at these two little monkeys, these little cloned monkeys in the incubator picture here in China. What was the motivation for Chinese scientists? Just the fact that they could do this? Or what do they hope to learn from these monkeys now that they're here?
The scientists were not thinking anything about human clones. They were thinking about what I was discussing, namely models for human disease, whether or not that could be an important approach going forward. And in particular, they were excited about the chances of coupling this new breakthrough with gene editing techniques called CRISPR. In particular, they're wondering if for future research on specific genetic mutations, this could really be, you know, a sort of Goldilocks opportunity. Although researchers have managed to clone non-human primates in the past couple of decades, they had to use other techniques, including a similar nuclear transfer method, but that relied on embryonic stem cells instead of somatic cells. And somatic cells will be much easier to program way earlier on, and as a result, if you try to edit those genes, all the edited genes will be the same. You won't have issues that researchers are concerned about some of them being slightly different than the other ones, a phenomenon called mosaicism.
So just to reiterate in our last 30 seconds here, I mean, this is the first primate ever cloned. You think about that. I mean, give us the significance of that moment from a scientific perspective in about 20 seconds.
Yeah, so it's the first time they've ever been cloned with this approach, not cloned at all.
Yep.
But the exciting thing about that is it opens up a whole new field of research going forward. And if we want to get some answers that have previously been intractable about human disease, this could be the way. Mm.
Dina Fine-Marin, editor of Health and Medicine at the Scientific American. Great to have you, and thanks for the information.
Thanks.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We are there. Tomorrow, we'll look at the World War II film Dunkirk. It's up for 8 Academy Awards. We'll look at the history behind that harrowing battle. Good to have you with us today. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.